The Gospel according to Genesis. It's been a while since we've been in the book of Genesis, but I've committed to taking us through the book of Genesis as a church, and so far we've had two different parts, and I'm going to give you a little bit of a recap before we jump in. Today we're looking at the Gospel according to Genesis, part 3. Now the term gospel comes from the Greek word euangelion, which clearly sounds exactly the same as gospel. But what that word means is simply good news. But from the Christian perspective, and when Christians use the term the gospel, they mean specifically the good news of Jesus Christ. Now, you might be wondering, how is the gospel, how is the good news of Jesus Christ in the very first book of the Bible? If I open up my Bible, you know, Genesis is right here, and Jesus doesn't show up until, like, way around here somewhere. And so, where is the gospel in the book of Genesis? Well, the good news, see what I did there? Is that as followers of Jesus, we believe in a God who has a plan. We believe in a God who's sovereign, who's orchestrating the events of history. He's not just haphazardly reacting to things that are going on. He doesn't see a war here or a crisis here or even a broken down car here and goes, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? He's got a plan. He's got a plan. It's woven throughout all of history. In fact, it is his story. And so when we read the Bible as the unified story that leads to Jesus, we can see elements of the gospel woven all throughout the biblical text. Right from the very first words on the very first page of the very first book. There are hints, there are shadows, there are reflections of things that are to come. And as this is part 3, I wanted to give you a little bit of a recap on where we've been so far in the book of Genesis. You can think of this as the previously on that you skip over when you're watching your favorite show. So if you've missed either of these parts, it's okay, don't despair. On our website, we have all of our sermons posted, and you can go back there and listen to these if you want to. So in part 1, the theme was, you need a better story. You need a better story than the one that you've been told. There are more and more stories out there that the world tells us. Offers countless stories of self-fulfillment and creating your own identity. But God actually gives us our identity. It's not something that we earn. It's not something we have to grasp or struggle for. It's actually something that we receive. And so when we rest on the fact that our identity is freely given, it's both a very offensive idea to our culture, but it's also a very liberating concept, and it's definitely worth exploring and definitely, definitely worth living. And the series followed how God created us to be in a relationship with him, but we wanted to write our own story. And the results of that brought the curse, brought sin, it brought shame, struggle, and ultimately death. All of these things entered into the story of human existence. In the words of Mark Sayers, we wanted the kingdom without the king. We wanted the blessing of God without God. We wanted all the things that God gives us and that are great, but we wanted it our own way. But right from the start, there was a promise that one day sin and death would be defeated. If all of creation fell through Adam, God would bring a new Adam who would restore it. Then we come to part 2. And the theme of part 2 was faith is the way forward. In a world of endless options, contradicting experts, and unqualified opinions, how are you supposed to know what to believe? How are you supposed to know which way is up and which way is down? But my challenge to you and God's challenge throughout that series is that deconstruction is not an answer. You can deconstruct your faith, you can rip it all apart, but at the end you're just left with pieces. There has to be some sort of way to reconstruct them back together again. And faith is the only way out of the prison of doubt and despair. It's the only way to a relationship with God. And so this series followed the patriarch of Israel, Abraham. And Abraham was chosen by God to bring life and flourishing to the whole world, to be a blessing to everyone. And he was a deeply flawed man, much like you and me. He was deeply flawed, and his first act of the man of blessing, the man called to bring blessing into the world, his first act of blessing is actually to bring a curse on the people of Egypt. Not off to a great start. But he had moments of transcendence, moments where he got it. And he was made right with God because of his faith, not because of his ability to be particularly good or smart or spiritual. He became the father of Israel, who was called the blessed world. And now through Jesus, the new Adam, we are too called to be children of Abraham. And the responsibility of being the blessing people is now on us as well. And so as we enter part three of this series, our theme is, lose your life to find it. And we're going to be taking a look at that theme of blessing. We're going to take a look at blessing and cursing and what it actually means to live the good life. We'll follow the life of Abraham's grandson, Jacob, who from the very womb is a lying, treacherous snake. And how on earth will God's plan to bless all of humanity survive through his hands? Are you ready? All right, let's go to Genesis chapter 25. We're going to start in verse 19. If you don't have it with you, that's okay. You can follow along on the screen. We're going to read quite a bit, but it's worth it. Trust me. Genesis 25, starting in verse 19. This is the account of the family of Isaac, the son of Abraham. When Isaac was 40 years old, he married Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean from Paddan Aram, and the sister of Laban of Aramean, the Aramean. Isaac pleaded with the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was unable to have children. The Lord answered Isaac's prayer, and Rebekah became pregnant with twins. Now, if you remember from the story of Abraham, Isaac's mother wasn't able to have children either, but God miraculously intervened, so there's a theme there. Verse 22, but the two children struggled with each other in her womb as she went to ask the Lord about it. Why is this happening to me? She asked. And the Lord told her, the sons in your womb will become two nations. From the very beginning, the two nations will be rivals. One nation will be stronger than the other, and your older son will serve the younger son. And when the time came to give birth, Rebekah discovered that she had indeed was going to have twins. The first one was very red at birth and covered with thick hair like a fur coat, so they named him Esau. Then the other twin was born with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so they named him Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when the twins were born. Now there's three things that I want you to pick up here. The first thing is that this is the story of two nations here. These aren't just two kids, this is two nations. And they're going to be bitter rivals. But only one is going to come out on top. The younger is going to rule over the older. And the second thing of critical importance is that this would be a shocking revelation to ancient Near Eastern culture. Because the eldest son is the one who would take on the family name. The eldest son is the one who would be blessed by the father and carry on the lineage. Yet, to the readers of Genesis, this should not come as a surprise to us. Because there's this reoccurring theme, this reoccurring pattern where God chooses the younger to carry out his plan of blessing. Abel was chosen over Cain. Isaac was chosen over Ishmael. Later, we'll see that Rachel is chosen over Leah, and Joseph is chosen over his older brothers as well. And so we have to ask ourselves, why would God do this? Is he playing some kind of mind games here? Well, not at all. What he's doing is he's demonstrating that he chooses what we would consider to be second best, what we would consider unworthy, what is not the way that we do things is the way that he does things. Remember, he also chose two women who were barren to carry out the promised offspring. If the blessing is going to come to the whole world, it will be God's way and not our own. It will confound the wise. Now, there's a third thing I want you to notice here as well. I want you to notice the boys themselves. Esau, the firstborn, by seconds, as Jacob probably reminds him, for the rest of his life, was a hairy baby. Now, I just have to say, hairy babies are the cutest babies. I'm sorry, but they are. Hairy babies are the cutest babies. They come out with, like, a mullet, and it's just... Esau, on the other hand, like, when you read this description, it sounds like he came out with a 5 o'clock shadow. So I don't know what was going on there. And his parents, it must have startled his parents and really made an impression on them, because they decided to name him Esau, which means hair. So that was his name. And the struggle that Rebecca had felt in her womb as she was praying to the Lord was not an illusion, because the second child comes out grasping at his older brother's heel. And so his parents named him Jacob, which means heel. Again, you know, it's a little on the nose there. But heel, it also means deceiver. And so Jacob literally comes out of the womb struggling for first place, grappling to earn the blessing of the firstborn, a gift that God wanted to give him in the first place. Remember that? And in the conversation that the Lord had with Jacob's mother, he said, "This is the one that I'm blessing." But Jacob's already fighting for it in the womb. But there's more. We're going to keep reading. Let's pick up on verse 27. This is when the boys have grown up. As the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter. He was an outdoorsman, but Jacob had a quiet temperament, preferring to stay at home. Isaac loved Esau because he enjoyed eating the wild game Esau brought home, but Rebekah loved Jacob. You see here that these boys could not be more different from night and day. We've got mama's boy and dad's favorite. One day when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau arrived home from the wilderness exhausted and hungry. Esau said to Jacob, "I'm starved. Give me some of that red stew." This is how Esau got his other name, Edom, which means red. Again, all these names are a little on the nose. But Edom was the name of the nation that would come from Esau. And so that's a pretty disappointing name to be reminded of this story every time your nation's name is given. "All right," Jacob replied, "but trade me your rights as the firstborn son." "Look, I'm dying of starvation," said Esau. "What good is my birthright to me now?" I think Esau had a flair for the dramatic, don't you? But Jacob said, "First you must swear that your birthright is mine." So Esau swore an oath, thereby by selling his rights as the firstborn to his brother Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and lentil stew. Esau ate the meal, then got up and left. He showed contempt for his rights as the firstborn. Now, I have to be honest, this story infuriates me. And I don't know what bothers me more. I don't know if it's Jacob's scummy way of taking advantage of his older brother, or the fact that his older brother couldn't be bothered to care about his birthright. So often when we read the Bible, we're looking at the story and we become perplexed and confused because we're like, where's the good guy? Isn't Jacob the good guy in this story? But there's no good guy in this story. Like all of so much of history, it's rarely black and white. And there is no hero in this story. Just two broken people looking out for their own self-interests. It's worth noting that God was not cruel in overlooking Esau. So I think sometimes when we read this story, we think that God was mean to Esau because he said, "No, it's going to go to Jacob." But let's remember that Esau very freely gave up the blessing of God for a bowl of stew. And so I don't think that God made any mistakes here. It literally says that he showed contempt for his birthright as the eldest. But when we look at the scheming opportunist that's Jacob, it hardly seems any better that way either. So that's where we're ending for the day. I'm not done talking yet, but that's where we're ending for the day. That very unsatisfying cliffhanger. You know, this account leaves us with a lot of questions, not the least of which, what is the way to the good life? What is the way to the good life? You know, on our wedding day, Melanie and I had said our vows, and, you know, I kissed my bride, and they introduced us as Mr. and Mrs. Bott. And we walked down the aisle. We walked down the aisle to the song Good Life by One Republic. Anyone familiar with that song? It's a really upbeat, kind of toe-tapping, like, ride down on the ocean on a summer day with the top-down kind of vibe to it. And I'm not going to sing it for you, because I tried. Actually, when I was writing the sermon, I was like, I'm going to try singing this. And I was like, that is so off-tune. It's just not worth it. It's just not worth it at all. But it goes like this. Oh, this has got to be a good life. This has got to be a good life. And it sort of just repeats that. And isn't that what we all dream of? You know, whether you're trying to keep up with the Kardashians, embracing minimalism, taking up yoga, or partying like there's no tomorrow, we are all trying to experience our own version of the good life. And to put this back into the context of our story, I'm using the term good life synonymously with the word blessing. Because biblically, there is a lot more to a blessing than sneezing. Okay? It's not just something that you say to someone when they sneeze. It's very deep. It carries a lot of meaning, a lot of weight. I was listening to the Bible Project podcast. I would recommend it to anybody who wants some of the maybe difficult themes of Scripture explained in a very simple way. The Bible Project is fantastic. And I was listening to their episode on Jacob, and they do an excellent job of summing up the idea of a blessing and a curse. They say this: a blessing is abundance, multiplication, flourishing. It's a gift from God, and it's something that humans are meant to steward. And then we have the curse, which is the opposite, when life folds in on itself. Human flourishing, that's the blessing. That is the good life. And this, of course, comes out of Genesis chapters 1 and 2 and into 3 when we look at the curse, where God blesses humanity. He says, you know, he says, be fruitful and multiply, right? Bring life into this world, right? Rule over it. And then finally, through an act of harsh mercy, he curses them when they bring sin and death into the world. And the entire story of Genesis is about God trying desperately to bless people and people rejecting his blessing in order to pursue their own version of the blessing. And in the story of Esau and Jacob, we see two equal but completely opposite ways that we can resist God's blessing. The first is through striving. Right? It's embodied in Jacob. He takes a particularly aggressive stance, from jujitsu in the womb to, like, making business deals over a bowl of stew. Jacob's mantra is simple: whatever it takes. You know, I can picture him saying to a grumbling Esau later around the campfire, you know, bro, it's nothing personal, it's only business. Right, whatever it takes, I'm going to get to the top, I'm going to get the blessing of God, and I'm going to make sure it happens. How often, in an effort to get ahead, do we harm other people? We struggle and we fight our way to the top so we can finally breathe. As the classic line from U2 goes, we're running to stand still. But our striving is not only wearing ourselves thin, it's enacting violence on our entire environment. Wayne Mueller, who wrote a book on Sabbath, warns us of this. He writes, a successful life has become a violent enterprise. We make war on our own bodies, pushing them beyond their limits. War on our children, because we cannot find enough time to be with them when they are hurt and afraid and need our company. War on our spirit because we're too preoccupied to listen to the quiet voices that seek to nourish and refresh us. War on our communities because we are fearfully protecting what we have and do not feel safe enough to be kind and generous. War on the earth because we cannot take time to place our feet on the ground and allow it to feed us, to taste its blessing and give thanks. That sounds a lot like Jacob to me. Fearfully protecting what's his. And it sounds a little bit more like me than I care to admit as well. See, right here is the tragedy of the Jacob story. Striving to earn what God has already freely given. And this story is not unique to Jacob. This story is told over and over and over again in so many people's lives. The same blood runs through our veins. We do the same thing with the grace of God, don't we? We cannot accept that God would actually give us his son. That eternal life, a life of flourishing, could be given to us. You know, if we would just receive it. And so what we try to do is we try to earn the blessing of God. You know, get these seven keys to healing right. These three steps to being wealthy and whole. You know, sure, maybe salvation is free. I've got my fire insurance, but you have to earn the rest. And of course we don't say that, but we think it. We tell ourselves that. The second way that we can resist the blessing of God is contempt. Or maybe a better way to look at it is complete indifference. We have Esau who just did not care. He just could not be bothered. Unlike Jacob, who wanted the blessing more than anything in the world, Esau just wanted to live his own life. He cared more about the temporary pleasures of sin than he did about the blessing. We get an inside look at Esau's perspective in the book of Hebrews, Hebrews 12, verse 16, because it doesn't tell us a lot about what's going on inside in the story. You kind of have to infer a little bit. But Hebrews 12, 16 lays it out for us. Make sure that no one is immoral or godless like Esau, who traded his birthright as the firstborn son for a single meal. See, Esau was so focused on the moment that he neglected what was of eternal value. A bowl of stew, while it paled in comparison to being stool. Yeah, bowl of stool. That's I don't think I would trade anything for that. I'm just going to take a drink of water here. A bowl of stew. Paled in comparison to being the firstborn son, to being the person that got to carry on God's blessing to the world. And he traded it for what he desired in the moment. His desire for that stew was so strong that he said, whatever, I don't care. Just give me that right now. And we hear this mantra in culture all the time, live in the moment. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, being present in the moment. But when we sacrifice the blessing of God for the temporary pleasures of sin, we've completely rejected God's blessing. And there's a lot of Esau's who come to church. A lot of people who come in on Sunday, and then as soon as they walk out the door, it's all their own agenda and their own schedule and doing whatever they want. It's their life. God can have me in church on Sunday morning, and then the rest is mine. Stay out, stay away, back off. Because they don't really believe that God's life is a life of blessing. They don't believe that God actually wants what's best for them, that he actually cares about them, and that there's a reason that he says the things that he says, even if we can't see it. Others don't even play the game at all. They just openly reject faith in order to live their own life. And some of us are like Esau. Others of us are like Jacob. But as opposite as they could be, right? Like father, like son, mama's boy, mighty hunter, homebody, striving for the blessing, despising the blessing. The one thing that they both had in common is that they clung tightly to their lives. They both thought they knew the way to the good life, and they were both wrong. See, the problem with humans is that we don't know the difference between a blessing and a curse. We don't know the difference between a blessing and a curse. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, Joe, what on earth are you talking about? I'm pretty sure I know the difference between something that is full of life and flourishing and good and something that is withering and dying and smells like death and decay. I think I can figure that out. Well, it may not be as simple as you think. You know, Tim Mackey, again, in the Bible Project, he rewinds us back to chapter 1 and 2. God created the Garden of Eden for the first two people, Adam and Eve. And it was teeming with life. There was life everywhere. There was flourishing everywhere. The whole garden was a blessing. Everywhere you looked, things were great. The plants were growing. The animals, were flourishing. The relationship between Adam and Eve was better than you could imagine it. The relationship with God was on fire, and just, it was absolutely incredible. Everything that God had given them was a blessing. But there was one tree in the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And God said, that tree isn't a blessing. And Adam, all this other stuff is a blessing, but that tree is not a blessing. And Adam and Eve, they looked at the tree, and I thought, man, that looks like a blessing. And that sneaky, deceitful serpent, he said, it is a blessing. I'm like, man, it sounds like a blessing. And they picked that fruit, and they're like, man, it feels like a blessing. And I bet you when they tasted that fruit, it tasted like a blessing. But guess what? It was not a blessing. Instead, it brought the curse. It brought sin, death, evil into the world. You know, how often have you actively pursued what you thought was a blessing only to find death and decay hiding in the shadows on the other side? What we cling to so tightly is so often what causes our undoing. And then we're going to fast forward all the way into the New Testament when Jesus comes along. And Jesus comes along and he looks at the trail of human brokenness, following our ambition and our misguided desires and our efforts to attain the blessing. And he looks at that and he looks at the trail of brokenness and pain and suffering and hurt. And he says this in Matthew 10:39. If you cling to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for me, you will find it. See, the only way to know what a blessing is, to truly know what a blessing is to cling to the blessing himself, to cling to Jesus. The blessing of God has come. The new Adam is here. The one who has come to bring us back into a relationship with God has flung the doors wide open for us. And we have three options. We can despise his gift like Esau. You can say, no, my way is better. You can try to earn it like Jacob. You can say, that's too good to be true, and you're not going to pull one over on me. I'm going to earn that. Or you can let go of all that you hold on to, all that you hold most dear, and experience life and life in all of its fullness. There you go. There's the whole story of Jacob. The rest of it's just going to be trying to convince you that it's true. I'm going to invite the band to come on up. And as they do, I don't want you to lose this moment of what God's doing in your heart. Okay, just ignore those guys. And if God's tugging on your heart this morning, and you've been a little bit like Jacob, or you've been a little bit like Esau, or maybe a lot like one of those guys, and you want to come back a moment where you come back to Jesus, or you come for the very first time, this is your moment. And so I'm just going to ask you to bow your head with me. And if you want to, just echo this prayer in your heart. Dear Heavenly Father, I've got a lot of great ideas. I've got a lot of plans. I've got a lot of desires. I've got some serious ambition. But I'm nailing it to the cross. I'm going to let go of my life. And I'm going to cling to Jesus. I'm going to cling to Him who's truly good, who's truly right, who's truly just, who's truly mercy, who knows the way to true human flourishing. Jesus, I turn to You.